This is Open Line. I'm Ed Lentz. The fate of the veteran of the world's wars has always been something of a promise waiting to be fulfilled. For most of human history, people, mostly common people, have fought savage battles, died in droves from disease, and even in the best of times ate food of less than gourmet quality. Kings and countries tried hard to reward their veterans with land and money and other benefits. Sometimes the rewards more than made up for the privation. Often they did not. The history of our own country has seen much of the same. After the American Revolution, the new nation tried to reward its veterans, not with money, which it didn't have, but with land, which it had in abundance. Of course, the land was 600 miles away, over the mountains, in a place full of Native Americans, called Ohio. It was not until after the Civil War that a major effort was made to give pensions to America's soldiers as well as their surviving wives and children. The pensions were not large, but by the turn of the 20th century, a lot of people were receiving them. It was from these modest beginnings and further efforts after World War I, World War II, the conflicts in Korea and Vietnam, that the modern Department of Veterans Affairs was built. It is a large and complex organization, and many Americans believe that it does good work for good people who have served their country. And for many Americans who have benefited from these programs, that is probably true. Many, but not all. Our guest today is the author of a new book whose title suggests that all is not well in Veterans Affairs. Martin Schramm is the author of 5 books and has been national affairs correspondent for The Washington Post, bureau chief for Newsday, and a television documentary executive. His nationally syndicated column appears in more than 400 newspapers. His new book is entitled Vets Under Siege: How America Deceives and Dishonors Those Who Fight Our Battles. Martin Schramm, welcome to Open Line.
It's good to be on Open Line, and that was a very impressive introduction, by the way. You captured the flavor of the book and how the problem is not new, it's not recent. It goes back as long as we've been sending men and now women into battle.
Okay. After we have talked a bit about the book and the issues it raises, we'll open the phones and take your questions and comments. If you or someone you know has a good experience or a bad experience with the Department of Veterans Affairs, or if you'd simply like to know more about it, give us a call at 614-292-8513 or send us an email at openline@wosu.org. Martin, what is the basic theme of your new book, and are the problems you describe new ones? I think you alluded to the fact that they weren't.
Well, Ed, you're right. The problems are not new at all. The problems have been around, and shame on us all for having known that the problems were there for decades and failed to fix them. And the theme of Vets Under Siege really comes down to this, that an adversarial mindset has set in within the bureaucracy that is the Department of Veterans Affairs. And the VA too often operates through its adjudicators who actually handle cases where veterans are filing for benefits that they have earned and for others up the line as well. A mindset is set in that is adversarial, and it becomes operationally a Department of Veterans Adversaries. And what I'm basically saying is we need to change that mindset, and maybe by changing the name to the Department of Veterans Advocacy, change the name, change the operating principle that is the de facto way that that department works, and I think then we will finally be serving those we send to fight our battles by providing them with what they've earned, nothing more.
Well, because many of our listeners may not be fully aware of all the services provided by the Department of Veterans Affairs, can you just give us a brief idea of the scope of the work of the department?
Well, it is truly an impressive concept, a Department of Veterans Affairs, and it includes services that range from the medical. They operate hospitals, and some of them are very, very good these days, by the way. They provide all sorts of benefits if you've been injured in battle or come up with some other disability. There is a whole range of benefits that you're entitled to. If you need counseling, you're entitled to the counseling. And it goes on. But whether it's because dollars are limited and have always been over the years or what, these series of problems have existed, and we'll go through them later on as we talk, Ed. Mm-hmm. But the range of benefits and potential ways of providing for the veterans is indeed impressive on paper.
I guess the point that I was getting around to is that benefits are available to veterans, whether they've been in combat, whether they've been in a war zone, whether they've been disabled or wounded. Simply having served your country honorably entitles the veteran to certain benefits.
Oh yes, but those have changed too. There was the GI Bill that existed after World War II, and now most recently it is a new GI Bill has just been enacted, and once again veterans can go to college, for example. Those with the government picking up the bulk of the tab, and that's very impressive. That's very good. But you say there are benefits that are available. Benefits are available if they're approved. Getting them approved has turned out to be where the problem exists. The backlogs are thousands and thousands, hundreds of thousands of veterans are sitting there waiting to have their claims decided. And as we will talk later on, some of those decisions have been shameful. They've been mind-boggling. And the pattern has too often been, not by everyone, by the way, there are many very good people working at the VA, but by some, and often those in the adjudicator positions, to first deny. And if you can't deny right off the bat, at least delay. And these delays go on for 6 months, a year, sometimes longer. Then after the delay, then comes a denial of benefits that were earned. And then the veteran appeals, and it goes up to an appeals board, and they say, no, he earned those benefits. You got to give them to him. And then they go back to the same adjudicator who finds another reason to deny it. And in just a minute, I'll give you details of cases that are shocking, but sadly all too typical. And veterans have waited for years, sometimes many years, sometimes a decade, and sometimes even longer. And too often, veterans have even died waiting for their benefits to be approved. And once sometimes the benefits were approved only after they had passed away, and then the case dies when the veteran dies.
So I guess the real question that I'm asking at this point is, are you suggesting that the department in its entirety needs an overhaul, or is the department doing some things right?
The department is doing many things right, and under General Eric Shinseki, the new Secretary of Veterans Affairs, the department is making a number of efforts to rectify its wrongs, but the wrongs have been vast, and he knows it, and he has said that he has acknowledged the sort of wrongs that I've written about in Vets Under Siege. His predecessors did not do a very good job. Secretary Nicholson, former Republican National Party chairman, was not really suited to the job, I don't think. I think he was better off running the Republican Party. He did that well, but he didn't really tend to the problems that the VA faced. But examples like this, there was a veteran who was an MP, a military policeman from Tampa. He was a cop in Tampa before he fought in the Gulf War, and then the Persian Gulf War, and then the Iraq War. He was leading convoys on those most dangerous of all missions through the roads that were where roadside bombs were going off. And sure enough, one went off in front of his van, and he hit the brakes, and the truck behind him didn't, and it was a bad accident. He'd also it took him forever to get basic benefits after that. But more specifically, he had come back. He had seen children run over by the convoys, and saw his best friend get his head blown off. And he had post-traumatic stress disorder. Two doctors from the VA diagnosed it and were treating him for it. He applied for the benefits for it, and his adjudicator denied him benefits on the ground that he wasn't in combat. He was just an MP. And so then he had to try to prove that he was. Then they denied him benefits on the grounds that he didn't really have PTSD. And then he said, but it's your own doctors who said so. And then they denied him benefits. All this went back for appeals. Then it finally went back to him again. And they said, well, we're denying the benefits on the grounds that you cannot cite the specific incident that caused your PTSD. I mean, which was it? Was it seeing the kid run over or seeing the buddy lose his head? I mean, why are we doing this? It's not right. And I can give you dozens of cases, but every time I've written about them in columns or in my book, my inbox gets filled with emails from veterans or their next of kin telling me similar sad stories, and that's the saddest thing of all. Let's just fix that.
How did that particular case resolve itself, or is it still in the process of being resolved?
Last I heard, I didn't check back with Eric Adams in the past 6 months. It was still under appeal. But it bounces back and forth. We should not make the veteran have to make and prove his case when the documentation is there. The department's mission should be, we will take the evidence. We will match it up against what the criteria is. If it's there, we will make the best case for you and give you your benefits. If not there, then you can appeal. We should be making the case for the veteran. We shouldn't make the veteran fight the government after having fought the enemy for the government.
And it's been this way for some time.
For many, many decades. One of the saddest chapters of all is the one I call the most boring chapter in my book. And after all of the horror stories I'm presenting, this is one where I just go back and talk and quote government accountability agencies' reports that have gone back for 30 and 40 years, in which, sadly, they all read the same. The language is often the same. They've been making the same point, finding the same problem for decades, and yet we haven't fixed the problem. I like to hope that General Shinseki will succeed where others have not. I know he's motivated to. I hope he does succeed.
And does it seem that the president supports these sorts of changes as well?
He has said he does, and he does. And every bit as impressively, the most active advocate of veterans is the chairman of the House Veterans Affairs Committee, Bob Filner. He's from California, and he has he's endorsed the changes that I proposed in my book, and the examples that were cited are the sort that have spurred them to action. The House committee has been much more active than the Senate committee, okay, by the way, which is too bad.
We are talking this morning with Martin Schramm about his new book, Vets Under Siege, How America Deceives and Dishonors Those Who Fight Our Battles. This is Ed Lentz for Open Line. We'll be back in a minute or so.
On Talk of the Nation, we like to be clear about what we're talking about, whether it's movies.
A B-movie was a movie that was made specifically to be on the bottom half of a double feature.
Or the auto industry.
One mid-level executive at a top automaker told me, well, 30 years ago, we were a car company that would occasionally lend money to our customers, and now we're a bank that makes cars.
Talk of the Nation, clear, straight, open, from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation begins later this afternoon. It starts at 2 o'clock, right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. Good morning, I'm Amy Jarovich. Thanks for joining us for Open Line this morning. Currently 69 degrees in downtown Columbus at 1020. In the weather forecast for today, partly sunny skies and a high of 80 degrees this afternoon. Clear skies tonight and a low of 59. Warmer and sunny for Tuesday with a high of 86. You're listening to WOSU 820. Back to Open Line.
We're back, talking today with Martin Schramm about his new book, Vets Under Siege, How America Deceives and Dishonors Those Who Fight Our Battles. If you have a question or a concern or a comment about Veterans Affairs in general or perhaps your own case in specific or particular, give us a call at 614-292-8513 or an email at openline@wosu.org. Martin, we had been talking about some of the specific cases. You open your book with a troubling case of a man named Bill Flory. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. Bill Flory was really was every man. That he was just an ordinary guy fighting because his country called on him to fight. And so he went to war. He was an Army specialist. He was at Camisaya, which is in the Gulf War, which is was a weapons depot that the U.S. military captured, and what the CIA knew is that was where Saddam kept his chemical weapons, and when we talk about weapons of mass destruction, we never did find nuclear weapons, of course, because he didn't have them. He just was trying to get them, but he didn't have them, and nor biological. But he had and used chemical weapons for years against the Kurds, and he used them against the Iranians, and they were at Camisaya. And the Army went to destroy the stockpiles by the way they did it, by exploding them. The CIA didn't tell the Army said the CIA never told us, and then later found out that they did, but that's neither here nor there. A plume wafted over tens of thousands of U.S. soldiers after they detonated those weapons that were stored there, and this plume contained sarin gas. Years later, Bill Flory developed a growth on the side of his face at the temple, and first the VA told him that it wasn't cancerous, he was treated for it. Then they finally told him that it had been. Then when a bump on top of his head and his forehead occurred, they said that was not cancer. And then they found out it was too late. When he was applying during that whole period for benefits, on the grounds that he'd been exposed to the chemical weapons, he was told by the VA that it was, quote, less likely than not that it was the chemical weapons plume that had caused his cancer. But the VA did not bother to check its own best information. And I went and talked to a doctor, Dr. Robert Ware Haley of Dallas, who does the studies for the VA. And he told me how the VA should have checked it. Compare the soldiers who were exposed to the plume in Iraq with the soldiers of the same number, let's say in Germany, who weren't anywhere near the place, same age, same background, et cetera, and compare for brain cancer, how many died of it. The answer was it was really twice as likely as not. But they didn't tell us about that until 6 months after Bill Foley died. Mm-hmm. The VA had done him wrong. Flory was right. He never got his benefits. He died thinking that the VA had turned its back on him. And all he had done was try to be a good soldier and do his job.
Let's take a call now. We have a call coming in. Dennis, are you with us?
Yes, I am, and I truly appreciate this program. I heard the frustration in Mr. Schramm's voice. It's the same frustration that I go through when I represent some of my shipmates who are fighting with the VA. I made the front page of the Dispatch on October 13th and 18th of 2008. I am a combat decorated Vietnam veteran with a service-related disability for Agent Orange, and it took me 4 years fighting with the VA. And if you have time, I'd like to read you a short part of a letter from General Shinseki about this. May I?
Certainly.
All right. This is a letter sent to me by Bradley G. Mays for Shinseki. I'm going to leave part of it out. Dear Dr. Agin, it's Dr. Agin, Lieutenant Commander of the United States Navy, retired. Thank you for your letter requesting information regarding the Department of Veterans Affairs policy for service connection based on exposure to herbicides while in Vietnam. I skipped the next part. Well, this is for non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. One exception is that service connection for non-Hodgkin's lymphoma under 38 CFR 3.313 may be presumptively established if the veteran service this includes service in the waters offshore. Now, when Congressman DeBerry, and if he would call in today, he would verify it, held a meeting for veterans at the Columbus VA Outpatient Clinic, the gentleman from Cleveland for the disability sections came in, looked at me, shook my hand, said, I remember you from Congressman Kilroy's office. I said, that's right. I looked at him and said, what is the situation with blue water sailors and non-Hodgkin's lymphoma? His answer was, well, there isn't any. And I looked at him with anger and said, what do you mean you don't know? And Congressman DeBerry said to me, Dennis, please let him finish. He finished. I said, I'm going home to get the letter. I went home to get the letter that's in front of me now. That's May 13, 2009. Showed it to the Cleveland VA. They looked at it, scratched their head, walked out of the room. Came back in and said to Congressman DeBerry, he's absolutely correct.
I was going to tell you that you were indeed correct. The whole time you were correct, Dennis. Please go ahead.
But then I looked at Congressman DeBerry and said, Congressman DeBerry, is the Cleveland VA now going to notify all those who they turned down? And his answer was, that is a good question. I don't think they can or have tried to notify them.
Did you have another specific question for our guest this morning?
Yes. It goes with a letter from Shinseki on June 29th. Starts, Dear Dr. Agin, I'm responding to the letter you sent to Secretary Shinseki of the Department of Veterans Affairs regarding your concern that veterans who served aboard naval ships operating on the offshore waters of Vietnam do not qualify for a presumption of herbicide exposure. I skip the next part. Your letter indicates that you served aboard the USS Newport News CA-148 off the coast of Vietnam and received the presumption of exposure because there was sufficient evidence to show that you went ashore. Now, that is true. I was sent ashore without orders. There is no proof of it. I was never asked by the VA to show that or to tell it. What happened was I had to take a patient to surgery. The exo says, go check out a weapon. You're going in country. We're going up north. When you're all done, come and find us. And I did. There are no orders of that.
You see, Dennis, let me just interrupt for a second to make the point.
Please.
You're making. Dr. Agin is saying is basically the story that gets told time and again. War would be wonderful if it was so neat that we had a bunch of bookkeepers traveling around with our soldiers and sailors and airmen being able to account for every move that they're making. War is hell. Combat's tough, and you do things when you got to do them. And so you can't always record for the record each and everything that's done as done. But somewhere along the line, we've got to do what's right by our people. Does anyone think he didn't serve in the Navy at that period? Does anyone think he wasn't doing what he had to do? And does anyone think he doesn't have a non-Hodgkin's lymphoma? He does, he does, he did. So therefore, move on. Get it done. No backlog. Give this guy his benefits. That's what they should be saying. Fortunately, when it comes to Agent Orange, over the many decades since the Vietnam War, we finally began to get it right. And at first, troops, even men who were walking through the big muddy there on the ground, had to prove they were in a place that had been sprayed within a certain time period, et cetera. Finally, they relaxed that and they had some assumptions. And finally, they said, if you were in Vietnam on the ground there during this period, you're presumed exposed if you have any of the following things. And that sort of thing would be well to save you, Dennis, the heartache you're going through just to try to get benefits that it seems clear enough to me you deserve.
Okay. Thank you for your call this morning, Dr.
There is
Reagan.
Another thing, if I have a moment.
If we can keep it brief, we have to move
It'll
on.
It'll be very brief.
Certainly.
Mr. Schramm, are you aware that the VA did a study that 10% of all veterans have hepatitis C?
Yes.
Of that 10%, 63% served in Vietnam.
Yes. Yes,
and
I'm very familiar with that.
Recognize it. And I'll turn off.
Okay.
Listen, you have my telephone number. You can call me anytime during your show. I'll come back on. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Okay. One of the things we alluded to earlier was that this whole situation basically has many different facets and many different parts to it. One important point you mention in the book talks about the VA helplines and how much help they provide. Tell us a little bit about that in passing.
Well, that was one of the things that surprised me the most, because I used to hear stories of veterans telling me how they got wrong information, et cetera. But, of course, they're just ordinary folks calling up, and maybe they got it wrong, too. So, you know, I was never really sure about that. Then I started looking back, and I found that there had been a study that the VA itself did in 2002. They did what they called the mystery caller study, in which they had people call up the hotline that is supposed to the VA telephone line representatives are supposed to give callers information. And what they found was 22% of the VA telephone helplines gave information that was, quote, completely incorrect. That's more than one out of five. And another 23% gave answers that were only minimally correct. So now we're approaching almost half are either completely incorrect or only minimally correct. The VA service reps gave completely correct answers only 19% of the time. Some were very egregious. Here's an example of a mystery caller called him and said, my father served in Vietnam from 1961 and 62. Is there a way he can find out if he was exposed to Agent Orange? And the VA service representative said, well, he should know if they were spreading that chemical out there then. Only he's the one who'd know. And okay, and the caller hung up laughing. That was recorded. So part of it was an attitude that some had. I would say most of them did not have that attitude of the service reps on the phone. But the regulations were so complex, they couldn't get it right. And it shouldn't be that difficult. We should make it simple. We should make it quick. And we should be able to, if the VA's service reps can't get it right, then who can? Let's do what's necessary to help our veterans at least get the correct answers, if not the care and benefit they deserve.
And is it your view that that situation still continues at the present time with regard to those helplines?
It was 3 years later or 2 years later, a follow study was done, and the problem was in some ways even worse. In other ways, it was improved, but it was still unsatisfactory. They haven't done one of those studies since, as far as I know. It's time to do another one. But more important, I go back to my point. If we start off with understanding that there is a problem, and it is a mindset, and we have to take care of it, then once we take care of it, we can then know that everybody's at least trying to approach the problem in a problem-solving mode, and that would be the biggest thing of all. And they haven't done that. Even on Agent Orange, the last caller raised the point, you know, they had another thing, too, where they're still denying. They have a list of diseases that are approved to be covered, but not Parkinson's. And now is a time when a lot of Vietnam veterans are getting Parkinson's, probably a lot, right, of our listeners, people in Ohio. They insist that Parkinson's is not caused by Agent Orange. But studies done by the Mayo Clinic and the St. Jude's Children's Hospital that I refer to extensively in Vets Under Siege shows that what they found out is if you have a genetic predisposition toward Parkinson's and are then exposed to any kind of herbicide, whether you're a farmer or if you were in Vietnam, there is a significant increase that you will then wind up with Parkinson's, if indeed you had that genetic predisposition. So instead of messing around with this thing and denying benefits of those who may have had this contribute to their Parkinson's, give them the benefits and let's move on. That's what I think.
Okay. Dr. Agin mentioned hepatitis. And
yes.
And you mentioned that you were aware. Could you tell us a little bit more about that study and what that seems to imply?
Well, I wanted to go back and find out what that was. I was aware of it. I made reference to it in my book, but I didn't focus on it. And I don't know where they are now on hepatitis C, and I wanted to be sure I get it right before I mislead our listeners.
Okay.
But I need to do more reporting to find out just what it was. But basically, there was a big controversy about whether hepatitis C was contributed to by exposure to the herbicide or pesticides, for that matter, and they found out that it was, but only after many had been denied initially. And I don't know where that stands now, Ed.
Okay. You mentioned near the start of your book, in a chapter called Decades of Waste, you had also mentioned the studies earlier of the GAO and others about reporting about delays, but apparently there has been some problem with waste as well, and it goes back quite a long way. Say a couple of words about that with us?
Well, you know, it's often unconscionable the number of times that veterans benefits cases are shunted back and forth between the initial adjudicator at the VA, who's an adjudicator, by the way, a young person right out of college, very often, who may or may not have any experience with veterans in their own family or their own life.
So it just stretches out and stretches out.
Right, and they I referred to it earlier. They will approve. They will deny a case. It goes to an appeals board, and they say no. This is remanded back to you. You should be approving this. And then they'll come with to the same adjudicator, who then seems to justify his or her role by trying to find a new reason to issue a new denial for the same claim. And it goes back and forth, and it goes for years. More than 13,000 veterans have died while their cases were being appealed.
We'll talk more about this after a minute or two. We're talking today with Martin Schramm about his new book, Vets Under Siege, How America Deceives and Dishonors Those Who Fight Our Battles. This is Ed Lentz, and this is Open Line.
Hi, it's us, Click and Clack, the Tapper Brothers, here with a time-honored way to dispose of your car.
It's fast, reliable, and takes just one phone call.
It's the Car Talk Vehicle Donation Program.
Oh, I thought we were talking about a fire.
No. You get a tax deduction, and your station gets the proceeds. Call 1-866-789-TMCP.
TMCP?
Yeah, take my car, please.
That's 866-789-8627.
And good morning. Thanks for joining us for Open Line this morning. Currently 71 degrees in downtown Columbus at 10:40. In just about 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, hour two of Open Line begins. Kindergarten has been a part of American education for quite a long time. In fact, one of the first kindergartens in America was founded here in Columbus. Today, a discussion of the value of all-day kindergarten versus half-day kindergarten. A panel of educators join Ed Lentz for Open Line at 11 o'clock, right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. Partly sunny skies today, a high of 80 degrees. Clear skies tonight and a low of 59. Sunny and warm for Tuesday with a high of 86. Get more from WOSU anytime at WOSU.org. Podcast new and archived news stories from WOSU and NPR. Listen to an interesting story again or get the news on your own time. Podcast news anytime online at WOSU.org. And now, back to Open Line.
We're back. This is Open Line. I'm Ed Lentz. We're talking this morning with Martin Schramm about his new book, Vets Under Siege, How America Deceives and Dishonors Those Who Fight Our Battles. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call at 614-292-8513 or an email at openline@wosu.org. Martin, we've been talking about a variety of issues here. One of the other points brought up in your book is how not just people who have to go in and spend a little time with VA hospitals, but outpatients as well have a number of problems getting their issues addressed by the VA. Tell us a little bit about that.
They do indeed. And I must say, this is one area where the VA is moving to deal with the problem. Not always in the best or fastest way, perhaps, but they've made significant gains. But here's the problem. not everyone can be living right close to a VA hospital. I think you've got one. I'm trying to think if you have one in Columbus. I'm not sure where your nearest VA hospital is there, Ed. But if you live close to one, you can go and get treated there. That's great. If you live far away from one, you often have to drive quite a distance to get the treatment you need. The fellow that we referred to at the very start of the book and earlier in the show, Bill Flory, was out in Oregon with his grandparents being treated for hideous cancers that had were really killing him. Head and brain cancers, and he had to go 6 hours to get to the VA hospital. That meant he had to have someone driving him, and then he had to be treated, and they had to stay somewhere, and it was a huge ordeal. They had a hospital right in the town where he lived, but he couldn't go there. Oh. What I was saying I think we ought to do is give them a card, kind of like a Medicare card. It just says, hey, you have this. You're welcome for treatment at the VA hospital. It's fine. It's large. We can handle it. If you can't get there easily, go to the hospital near you, give them the card, you'll get treated. We pay.
Okay. We're going to move on and take another call here in just a moment. I do want to mention in passing, we had a message come across from Dr. Agin who says here that a hepatitis C apparently can be spread by the kickback from an air jet gun used for vaccination along the way. In any case, we're going to take a different call now. Tom, are you with us? Do you have a question or comment?
Yes, hi. I really feel for the veterans, how they're being treated, and I really support your guests' efforts. But I just want to say that this isn't the result of just some young people trying to give an excuse for their job. If you look historically, this is always how it happens. Every time there's a war, we tell the young people that they're heroes, our heroes. Anybody that doesn't like the war, they say you're not supporting the troops. They send them off, and when they come back and they can't fight anymore, they tell them to get lost. And every time there's a war, you can count on certain veterans groups getting out there and waving the flag and cheering them on and wearing their uniforms. And when the kids come back all messed up, you can count on them being shafted. It's because they go off to war for the people who want to make money off of it. And they come back from war and they cost too much money. And I think, you know, someday maybe we'll wake up to this. Because, you know, I told people before these wars ever started that, you know, when they come back, the veterans are going to get the shaft, just like always. And here it is. And it's not just the system is messed up. It's by design. the people who said support the troops don't support the troops. They support getting the troops out there. That's all I got to say.
Okay. Listen.
Well, your caller makes an interesting point, Ed, and I've written about that in my book. You can go back to World War II, and I did quite a bit, and talk about what happened to veterans then and now. Sailors in the Pacific who, after World War II, they wanted to test in the Bikini Atoll those nuclear weapons and just what happens after one explodes. And they sent them in there, and they were contaminated, and they were denied benefits for decades afterwards, and they were jerked back and forth. And I tell the very sad stories of some of them dying in the 1980s after being in failing health and having other problems for so long, not getting what they were paid. And others who were World War II veterans having all sorts of benefits now that they seemed clear that they deserved and were denied repeatedly through that chain that I've talked about before of the waste of the sheer waste of going back over the same case 5, 6, 7, 8 times with all sorts of lawyers and doctors testifying for each case just to prove that they deserve the benefits that they never got.
Okay. One of the more interesting parts of your book, I thought, was the chapter entitled Ratings, Games, and Waiting Lists. Persons with disabilities are given a percentage as to disability, 10% or 20% or 30%. And your book talks in some detail about how, well, the chapter title asserts, a ratings game can sometimes be played as well. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Well, that's exactly right. When a veterans board has said this person on appeal does deserve to be paid for his benefits, then the question is, how do you rate the benefits? And very often what you would see is benefits would be partial but not total. And these things would go back and forth, even in some instances when I gave examples of when it was so clear that this person was just unable to function anymore. Benefits would be not denied, but just given a minimal rating, and it was all sorts of ways of saving money, and that's one of the things it comes down to. You know, we had that caller just a minute ago, Ed, who made the point this has gone on forever, and yes, it has. But one of the things we have to keep in mind is that budgets are finite. The VA has just a certain amount of money that it's given and allowed to spend, and that's part of our other problem we have to focus on, which is that. What is the cost of war? The cost of war, when you've got airplanes and battleships and guns, is you make them, you send them to war, they are used in war, and then they come back, and then you provide maintenance and you rehabilitate them and you make them good to go again, as long as they're not obsolete. Service people come back and. The cost of war is not figured into the budgeting. Figured into the budgeting is just what the cost of war is when they're over there fighting. And then they come back. But this should be part of the cost of war.
Okay. We have another call coming in. Carol, do you have a question or comment for us this morning?
Yes. Is this me? Am I?
You're on open line.
Okay, thank you. My name is Carol, and my dad was a merchant seaman in the Second World War, and he was actually kept out of the anything until the very end because he was an electrician. He was on building the ships, the refrigeration units and stuff like that. But at the very end of the war, he was, and those merchant seamen were chopped up pretty badly. He's got, you know, all kinds of shrapnel wounds and abdominal wounds and things like this and loss of hearing. And but, you know, they were denied, as I understand it, benefits for so many years. They got nothing. And he's 86. He's not doing well. And we're trying to get some help for him for some of these medical things he's going through. And I just wonder if you could discuss the history of this a little bit, because I don't know that it's all that well known that these guys were out there in those ships with practically no protection and were almost blown up every day, and yet they denied them anything.
Carol, that's a good point you raise, and it's true. And and what you're going to be finding now as you're trying to go back and apply is that the same thing that that World War II veterans are finding, what if they were, rather than just Merchant Marine, if they were regular Navy or Army or whatever. The fact of the matter is, or Coast Guard, that it's increasingly difficult for people who are now in their 80s to be filing claims for injuries and problems that happened when they were younger. In Vets Under Siege, I write about a fellow named Irving Levin, who lives in Stuart, Florida now. And in 1945, he was on a bombing raid over Tokyo. His plane got hit by Japanese fighters, and he crash-landed at Iwo Jima. And it was, as a young man, things had flown around the plane there, and it was hit in the back of the head and the neck. But as a young guy, he shrugged it off and he went on after he was discharged. And yet, as he got older, the cervical spine damage became a huge problem for him. And it took 19 years before his case finally got decided. In 1988, it was when he filed his first claim. So then finally, it took 19 years. It should have taken 19 minutes. Common sense should have told us this fellow deserves these benefits. In 2007, 2 decades after he filed his claim, the appeals were over. He won his case, and the Court of Appeals said the VA adjudicators and the appeals board should have ruled that it was, quote, at least as likely as not that his injury was caused by that crash landing initially, and this should have been settled in just minutes.
Martin, we have an email who came in from a listener. In brief, it says, having worked and trained in several different VA hospitals over the last 20 years, I can certainly attest to several of the problems which your guest has written about. There are some employees in the VA who care, some who are just there for the paycheck. Others are just interested in advancing their own careers. None of the above situations is helped by consistent underfunding on the part of Congress. Yes. Although the vet patients are understandably angry, directing their anger at the average person behind the desk, and it's probably one reason why VA employees burn out. Thoughts on funding?
That's one thing that is finally being taken care of at least a bit. The Obama administration has accomplished this and with a very aggressive House Veterans Affairs Committee, as I said, chaired by Congressman Filner of California. They have pushed through record funding for the VA, very significant increases, and that's good, and it's necessary. And the point I was making before, just to sum it up again, is taking care of our veterans after they come home from war is part of the cost of war, just as taking care of the airplanes and the aircraft carriers and the battleships, part of the cost of war.
We have another call coming in. This is Pat. Pat, do you have a question or comment for us today?
Yes. My comment is my husband, who died several years ago, was in World War II. And as he aged, he got Parkinson's and he had several diseases. We have so many good hospitals nearby, he never would have dreamed of going to a VA hospital. And I guess my question is, and you mentioned somebody who had a perfectly good hospital in their town, but they had to travel a long way to a VA hospital. I'm wondering, why don't veterans avail themselves to just local hospitals? And if it has to do with cost, my question is, if we have a new health care plan where we have universal coverage for everyone, will that alleviate some of this, let's say, reluctance of a veteran to go to just his local hospital versus having to search out a VA hospital? That's my question.
Okay. Well, the answer I've made in my book, Pat, is that we should issue veterans a vet health card. just like let it operate just as a Medicare card, which can say go of course to a VA hospital if you're close enough to one to do it. If there is nothing nearby, then by all means go to your local hospital, give them the card, and get covered the way people on Medicare get covered now. The VA, I never did answer that question before properly, has opened a number of clinics, local clinics, that makes it easier for people to go and get treatment for basic things and to get counseling and things like that. That's good, but they have to have enough counselors to do it, and vets are getting turned away even from those because they just don't have any available counselors.
We have several calls coming in. We'll try to take as many as we can in
Please
just
do.
A very few minutes we have left. If we can keep our comments brief, we will appreciate it. Joyce, do you have a quick question or comment for us?
Just a comment. I just got back from the VA clinic, and I'm just putting in a plug in for the Thomas T. Wiley Clinic. There's nothing they say that scares me. Because I'm rated high enough, I get 100% of my vet care there, my health care there, and there's nothing they say that scares me more than we have to send you to a civilian doctor because I know I'm going to be in for lots of paperwork, lots of waiting from the civilian. When I go to the VA clinic, it is so smooth. It is flawless. I never wait. I get everything done. I go to the civilian doctor. I'm still arguing over a bill that they cannot understand. The VA is not campus.
It should be seamless in both places. And I do... I understand very well your frustration, Joyce. It shouldn't be. And the VA does provide good service in a number of places very often, not all by any means. And you'd only wish that could happen in private hospitals too. Any listener who's ever gone to an emergency room in any hospital anywhere, private, public, whatever, knows what it means to wait and suffer.
Just as we're running out of time this morning, I have about less than a minute left. We had another thought from Dennis Agin about Congressman Bob Filner's House Bill 2254 to rescind boots on the ground. Any last thoughts on that, Martin, before we
conclude? I don't want to give any last thoughts on that until I go back and read the bill.
There we go. Okay, we've had with us...
Give me a break.
Okay, we've had with us this morning Martin Schramm, whose new book is called Vets Under Siege, How America Deceives and Dishonors Those Who Fight Our Battles. And, Martin, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Ed, you made it move fast. Thank you so much.
This is Ed Lentz on Open Line. Have a good day.